If you've gone to a county fair or maybe the state fair, chances are you saw 4-H kids showing their animals and displaying their products. But 4-H is much more than that, and our guest today thinks that it's the key to increasing agricultural literacy. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest today is Kira Butler, senior editor at Mother Jones, where she writes and edits stories about the environment, nutrition, health, and agriculture. And she's the author of the book we're going to be talking about. It's titled Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever. And Kira, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry.
I think was first exposed to 4-H as a 7-year-old and was a member of 4-H right up until I could until I turned 18 and they wouldn't have me anymore.
Oh, that's great to hear.
So I have a lot of great experiences and wonderful experiences about 4-H. So it was wonderful to read your book today and sort of be reminded of a lot of the things about 4-H that were great, at least in my mind, for sure. You start the book by talking about the disconnect many people have between the food they eat and where it comes from. And I wonder if you just give some examples, maybe from both adults and children.
Yeah, you know, there have been many, many studies done on the lack of agricultural literacy in the United States. And there have been a number of surveys where researchers ask both adults and children to talk about where their food comes from. I give an example in my book of a 10 or 11-year-old girl who a researcher says, well, why do you think there are different colors of cows? And the little girl says, well, I think that brown cows exist to produce chocolate milk. So that's one example. And then there are other examples with adults that are just more about the stereotypes that people have about farms. So, you know, usually in these surveys, when the researchers will ask adults what they think of as a typical farmer, the adult will say, oh, you know, I imagine a guy in overalls with a hayseed coming out of his mouth, and, you know, he's driving a tractor, and, you know, it's like in some cases that's probably correct, and in other cases farmers look a whole lot different from that today, but people just don't realize the diversity of careers that agriculture is today.
Yeah, it's really a lot broader than that. What really concerns you most about that lack of knowledge and understanding?
Well, it's the fact that people vote. You know, we literally vote, and we vote with our dollars at the supermarket. And to not know anything about where this food that we're buying and these fabrics that we're buying, where those things are coming from, that means that we're not educated and we're not able to make ethically and morally defensible choices when it comes to our food and our fibers.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your mind, should increasing ag literacy be a priority for us?
I think absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. You were raising urban poultry when you happened upon a county fair and you came across 4-H kids showing their animals. Describe that for us.
That's right. So my friends and I, we were living at the time in Berkeley, California. And we were kind of going through this urban farming phase, and we had chickens and we were trying to raise these turkeys, and we were just kind of, you know, learning as we were going along. And, I was, you know, feeding my turkeys, canned tuna in order to give them enough protein. And, we got to the fair, we went to this fair, and I saw, you know, these little kids, like 6 and 7 year olds in their immaculate white 4-H uniform. And they had made these posters all about exactly how much protein turkeys require and, you know, how to get the feathers to shine. And, it, you know, these little kids were being raised with this kind of agricultural knowledge that we, as, you know, grown people in our 20s, completely lacked. And I was just really, really impressed and intrigued and captivated.
Yeah, you found it interesting. I found it really interesting that you said in your book that the workshops you took and the books and articles you read that had to do with sustainability, urban farming, and other related topics. There wasn't one that mentioned the 4-H experience that you just described. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I think one reason is that people don't think of 4-H as an urban thing. We were, you know, living in a city, and we were doing what we considered to be urban farming. People think of 4-H as being something that people out in the country do that has nothing to do with what people do in the city. But actually, it turns out that 4-H today is much, much more than that. You can find 4-H in schools, in after-school programs in the city, in, you know, camps that city kids go to. And it's actually much more than just raising animals. You know, 4-Hers today are learning how to build robots, how to use GPS, filmmaking. It's a really, really diverse organization that's not just for rural kids out in the country anymore.
Yeah, you're certainly right about that. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, by the way. I haven't given the phone number yet. And you are certainly welcome to phone in as you listen to us talk, as I visit with Kira Butler, author of the book that we are discussing today. And the book is titled Raise, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever. And the number to call, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or go to our Facebook page. The title, that's The Larry Mehler Show, and we're certainly welcome to have you participate. Maybe you participated in 4-H, or maybe you're a parent of a 4-H kid. Love to hear your thoughts and comments. What about the lack of ag literacy today? What do you see as ways to improve that? So all those good things as we visit with our guest, Kira Butler. Maybe you could for us sort of profile the book itself. You follow about six, isn't it? Six 4-H kids. And
five, yeah.
So talk about how you've got your book organized.
Well, you know, it's really at the heart of the book are the stories of these teenagers, these Northern California 4-Hers who devote so much of their time. They put in these long hours after school getting their animals ready to be shown at the fair. And, you know, they raise all kinds of animals. I followed kids who raised goats, sheep, and pigs. Yeah. And so I kind of followed them over the course of one fair season. So from the time they got their animals when the animals were really little until they showed them at the fair. And I went through the whole process of raising and training the animals with them. But interspersed with the kids' stories is a little bit about 4-H itself, its history, and how its history is intertwined with American farming and specifically with American agribusiness. The journey of reporting this book took me, you know, from Northern California with these kids all the way to Ghana, where I have a chapter about how 4-H has expanded its presence in the developing world, especially in Africa, and its partnership with DuPont, the American agribusiness company DuPont, there, and what that partnership is looking like on the ground with the teenagers in Ghana.
Yeah, sort of the contents of the your book, and it's I like the approach. It was great to hear about these kids and sort of the process that they go through learning about their animals, but also participating in 4-H. Kind of a cool way to do it, I think. Becky on Facebook wanted to kind of agree with you. She says 4-H is so much more than simply farming and animals. There are great technology projects, leadership projects for kids to get involved in, and really, truly something for every youngster.
You know, that's right. I was amazed at the diversity of programming, and especially here in the city, you know, one thing that I noticed is that while we do here, and I live in Oakland, California now, and there is a 4-H club in Oakland, and they've kind of figured out these amazingly creative ways for the kids who do want to raise animals to be able to do so. So, you know, kids here don't have space in their yards, obviously, to raise a goat. So the club in Oakland has found this this sprawling old yard next to this kind of eccentric, you know, old home in Oakland. And the owner of this home has allowed the 4-H club to keep their goats there. So, you know, the kids will go to this place after school to take care of their goats rather than having to keep the goats in their own yard. And then, you know, for kids who don't want to raise goats, there are all kinds of other clubs. There are other projects. There are gardening projects. There are, you know, sewing projects. There are filmmaking projects. There's model rocket project. It's just, it's an amazing diversity of activities.
Yeah, it really is. In profiling the kids in your book, and they seem like really nice kids, did anything that they told you or what you observed them doing surprise you in any way?
Constantly. You know, they're teenagers, and I was really delighted and tickled by many of the things that they would tell me. You know, one thing that I never expected was the amount of kind of accessories that showing an animal at a fair requires. I went with one with this this very, very dedicated teenager, this teenage girl that I followed, Kelly. I went with her. I went around the fair, and I noticed that all of the lambs were wearing, like, these pajamas. And I was like, Kelly, what is up with these pajamas? And she was like, oh, yeah, those are lammy jammies. I mean, I think that's, like, you know, the nickname for them. They probably have a more technical name than that. But, and they come in, like, every pattern you could imagine, like skull and crossbone jammies and, you know, little hearts and flower jammies. And you as the sheep shower can get a headband that matches your lamb's jammies. So it's, you know, I had no idea this kind of level of detail that people really get into this. So that was fun to see.
Oh, and the amount of training that goes on, I know you observed some of that too, just with
animals. These kids get home after school and they go right out to their animals. And in some cases that means just going right outside their homes. But, you know, for Oakland kids who go to this shared space, that means either riding their bikes or, you know, getting a ride with mom or dad. And they spend hours. And in some cases at the very beginning, that just means, you know, sitting in the pen with the animal, getting the animal used to you so that, you know, you can work with the animal and it trusts you. But yeah, the amount of time I was so impressed at what these kids are willing to do, and the connections that they establish with their animals too.
Yeah. Lots of folks online. We should take some calls here and we will do that in just a second. Kira Butler, our guest today, she is the author of the book that we're talking about today. And the book is titled Raise. And the subtitle, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, talking about the importance of 4-H with author Kira Butler. Great to have her along. And again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Lori in Viroqua. Now, Lori, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I grew up, I was a 4-H kid my entire lifetime in Sauk County is where I grew up. But it's been 30 years since I've been a 4-H member. And I know that, you know, I'm aware of some of the urban 4-H programs and the sustainability, but I'm very much concerned about the use of 4-H by DuPont and the rest of the multinationals, agribusinesses, to spread this form of agriculture that we've chosen, presumably in this country, to use on most of our land, right? So my understanding is that 4-H was formed, or one of the impetus was to get hybrid corn into the countryside, and it certainly worked. When you look around us now, that's all we see is corn and soybeans. And the choices that they're making, that, you know, the kids in Ghana have no protection against the onslaught of this machine that has taken over this landscape. And now, yeah, we're changing the world's agriculture with this lie that this is going to, you know, this is the future of food. and I'm hoping. I saw your article in Mother Jones. I did not notice the. I haven't seen the book, so perhaps you get more critical of DuPont and their role and the methods that they use to inculcate children, you know. But it was a little bit in your article how kids after, you know, they couldn't afford the chemicals, but they're getting them on to this chemical intensive agricultural system when there are so many alternatives.
Kira, a comment from you?
Yeah, that's right. Just to give a little bit of context for folks who might not have read that piece in Mother Jones, which was based on a chapter in my book. So the way that the 4-H program works in Ghana, DuPont has provided a sponsorship for the 4-H in Ghana. So they're actually providing hybrid seeds, hybrid maize seeds or corn seeds, we would call them. And so they are distributing these seeds to the 4-H clubs in Ghana, which are run through schools, and the clubs are growing essentially demonstration plots with these hybrid seeds. And the idea is that the farmers in these rural communities in Ghana will see how well these hybrid seeds grow and will want to buy them themselves. So this first round of seeds that's provided to the 4-H club is freebies, but the idea is that, you know, afterwards that the farmers will want to pay for these seeds, which are drought tolerant and higher yielding than the traditional seeds that they use there. Now, the problem is that these seeds are like, you know, 10 times more expensive than the traditional seeds. And because they're hybrids, the seeds can't be collected again after the harvest. They have to be bought again season after season. And they also require, as our caller Lori was saying, intensive chemicals, you know, fertilizers and herbicides and pesticides in order to be grown at scale. So it kind of sets up this dynamic where the local farmers, if they want to buy the seed, are going to be dependent on the American agribiz company DuPont.
Lori, thanks for your call. I want to give Joanne in Green Bay a chance to join in. Joanne, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Wow, this is the first time I've actually gotten on the radio.
Well, glad to have you with us.
First of all, I was thrilled to hear on public radio, Kira Butler, I give you credit and I thank you and wish you great success in your work. I learned about industrialized farming about 8 years ago, and it's drastically changed. You were saying that when you go to the grocery store, you vote every time you buy. It amazes me that there are so many people who still are not aware of where their food comes from, or they don't care because they just want to buy whatever's the cheapest. And a question to you also, if you are familiar with Dr. Jane Goodall has a branch from her organization that's very similar to what you're doing called Roots and Shoots. If you're familiar with that and if there's any way that you could collaborate with the Roots and Shoots movement.
Hmm.
You know, I've never heard of Roots and Shoots, but I certainly am a great fan of Jane Goodall, so I will have to check that out.
Yeah? Hey. All right. Thanks, Joanne, for calling. Dominique in Cudahy, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for the show, Kira and Larry. Just wanted to say that growing up in a city, I had no idea what agriculture was outside of the stereotypical farmer with the straw hat. And, you know, I had no idea. Just go to the store and buy the food. But I had a life-changing experience when I was younger. I went to Camp Manitouish, and they pushed conservation and environmental stewardship, which kind of opened my eyes to there's more out there. And then I followed up with a high school teacher who worked agricultural literacy into the science lessons. And that's the point I'm trying to get to is he still was able to stick to the curriculum and teach all the lessons, but he related it to agricultural literacy and teaching, and it just opened my eyes, and it was such a great experience that I think that they could do a lot more of that and still stick to the curriculum because agricultural is so important today, and it also relates to so many different areas like economics and business and science. So that's where I'm just trying to go with this. I think that they could do more if they wanted to. They don't have to, add it to the curriculum as a class, but just little things to work it into the real life mm-hmm. makes a big difference.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, Dominique, but let's hear from Kira. Kira, what are your thoughts?
I think that's right on the money, and 4-H is actually doing a lot of that, too. There's a lot of the programs in 4-H that you wouldn't necessarily think at first are related to agriculture actually turn out to be. One example, there was recently some kind of a science fair that 4-H sponsored on a national level, I believe. And it was, on its face, it was about creating these, little Lego kind of robotic vehicles. But the challenge for the kids was to figure out how to make these vehicles do fun tasks like, loading hay bales and stuff like that. So the kids were learning about robotics, but, it was in the context of an agriculture-related task. And I think it's things like that, that when you can apply technology to agriculture, people begin to realize that farming today is so much more than that farmer standing there with a straw hat and a hay seed sticking out of his mouth.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, frankly, to think of an area of study where you couldn't work agriculture in as part of the classroom experience, frankly.
Yeah. I'm actually in the IT field, and I see it say I really enjoy reading technology-based articles that show how agriculture is integrating things like GPS and even the use of drones, aerial mm-hmm. Vehicles to monitor crops and things like that. It excites me because farming, I think the traditional method of farming is really inefficient, and science has brought us so far that I'm hoping that kids will become more interested because it's not so antiquated and looked at as such an old, feel that they're mm-hmm. exciting and fun.
Dominique, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate it. I want to give Trudy and Shell Lake a chance to join us. Trudy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to promote the work ethic that I believe being a member of the 4-H does for both adults and children. My husband was a 4-H'er, and he made sure that our three children became 4-H'ers when they were eligible. And our project was always raising and showing beef. And also, the end product was then sold to a buyer. My oldest daughter is 5'2", and she was in the beef project, and most of the beef she showed were around 1,800 to 2,000 pounds. So when she's a now certified public accountant, when she went for her first job interview, she included the fact that she had a beef project for 4-H. Once they got to that part of her application, the rest of her interview was all about, how did you ever accomplish showing beef at your size? And they were more taken by her project, and I think that project and other projects and work ethic all go together. And I truly believe that helped her get her first job.
Oh.
That is a wonderful story. And, it's interesting that she became an accountant because there's so much accounting that goes into 4-H livestock projects. It's all mm-hmm. about, as I learned from the kids that I followed, it's all about figuring out, how much am I going to be spending on feed and how much can I expect to get at auction, and will I then the next year be able to use my profit to buy maybe even a fancier animal or, exactly. Save up for a car eventually or put it into a college fund. There's so much about finance that these kids learn from these projects.
Yeah. I'd kind of forgotten about the record book part of it.
Yeah, but
it was I had dairy animals that I showed among other things, but the record books were, it was a lot of work, but you learned a lot.
Yes, and it involves the entire family. It's not just the child, it's the mom, it's the dad, it's the brothers and sisters and grandpas and grandmas quite often too.
Yeah. Trudy, thank you so much. Appreciate
thank
your call. You can join in, too. Maybe you've got a comment about 4-H. Did you participate in it? Are you a parent of a 4-H kid? Love to hear from you. What do you think about agricultural literacy today? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. And Trudy mentioned that it is a kind of a family affair, really. And adults, I mean, the volunteer adults do an awful lot. And what's even, from your way of looking at it, what, well, maybe you could explain a little bit about adult involvement in 4-H and then what maybe motivates them.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, just an army of committed adults who really are the backbone of 4-H. And often it will be parents of 4-H members, but sometimes there are volunteers who used to have kids in 4-H, and the kids are, you know, grown and out of the home, and the parent finds that they like being a part of 4-H so much that they continue to volunteer to give their time to this organization. One interesting thing about 4-H is that it's a very kind of bottom-up organization. So really the programming of each individual club is determined by the interests of those adults who are the leaders of that club. So, you know, if I'm a volunteer in a 4-H club and I'm really interested in, like, say, a particular kind of movie, I could start a project that's all around that kind of movie and see if there are any kids who want to learn about my passion. So I think that's a really, it's a great part of the organization that these projects are driven by people's passions and they get to share that enthusiasm with young people.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And Sue in Watertown, we'll give you a chance. Thanks for calling, Sue.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have a question for the author, and I came in just after it had started when I left Watertown. I'm on my way to Sun Prairie, which lets you know I'm out in an agricultural area, but came from Los Angeles. I just looked up the meaning of the 4-H clover, and I was very interested, and I think it fits in that it means the head, the heart, hands, and health. And I think that can be extrapolated to any kind of project that would help a 4-H member and the association.
You know, I think I can still do the 4-H pledge. Pledge my
head. Oh, can you?
Let's see if I can do it. It's been, I don't know how many years, I pledge my head to clearer thinking, my heart to greater loyalty, my hands to larger service, and my health to better living for my club, my community, and my country. I think that's it.
Well, and there you go. And your world onto the end of that.
And world.
Fabulous. Fabulous.
That's a recent addition, though.
Yeah, that's the world is a recent addition. We're talking a long time ago for me, but I'm kind of surprised that I can still remember that.
Yeah, nice work. I'm impressed.
So does that be covered in your, is it covered in your book that some of these children have used those? I heard the story about your daughter, and I thought that was fantastic. She's using.
Kira?
Oh, the caller's daughter who became an accountant. That was a fantastic story. That's right.
And I think those themes from the pledge certainly appear in many ways as you describe what the half dozen or so 4-H'ers that you work closely with as they went about their lives in 4-H.
Oh, certainly, yeah. You know, those four H's, I think, as you were saying, can really be extrapolated out into almost anything. You know, that I think there's recently been a lot of emphasis on the H for health. 4-H has become very interested in nutrition education, which obviously is a huge and important piece of food systems education. So there's been a lot of health initiatives recently, and I think it's wonderful to see the club going in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Sue, thanks again for calling. I want to give Kristen a chance to join in. Hi, from Madison. Hello. Hi, thanks for calling.
How are you? I'm so glad you're talking about 4-H.
And you have some experience with 4-H.
I do. I started 4-H when I was 8 years old in northern Montana. And I was club president from 8th grade to 12th grade. I had every project you can think of, but my main projects were steers and hogs. And by the time I was 18, because we did a lot of different fairs, I had enough money saved up to go to college for 4 years.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. That's what 4-H did for me. That's wonderful to hear. That's a much more, I don't know, noble use of your 4-H money than I've heard of a lot of kids right now. The most popular thing to do with money seems to be save up for a truck.
Yeah, I suppose. But saving for college is a really good idea. Thank you very much for calling. Ann in Madison, your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I also belong to 4-H from the earliest age that I was eligible until I was 18 years old. And the thing that impressed me at a young age most was having role models. I had a lack of role models in my life. And also belonging to a group. You know, I didn't go out for a lot of extracurricular activities in school, but I really enjoyed going to the meetings for 4-H and hanging out in the barns with the other show kids at the fair and just being part of the group.
Yeah.
You know, that's wonderful to hear, and that really struck me too, how this is such a social activity. You know, kids, especially the age of kids that I followed, teenagers, socializing is so important, and it's such a, you know, wonderful and positive kind of structure for socializing for them. And these kids...
Yeah,
you know,
and we learned how to square dance at our 4-H.
Learned how to square dance.
That's great. Yeah, at the fair, you know, these kids just, they help each other in the barn all day. I was really struck by watching these kids form these friendships and really kind of the spirit of collaboration in the barn, even though they're competing against each other. They really, you know, they have each other's backs.
Absolutely do. Ann, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. We'll give Jim and Superior a chance to join us. Jim, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Kira.
Hi.
Hey there, Jim.
Hi. I'm about, I know there's a lot of fantastic individual stories for 4-H and what it's done for people, but I'm curious about its history of being backed by agribusiness since its inception. And in that light, it seems like this innovation that we're always searching for with drones and robotic milkers is actually reducing the number of farms on the landscape.
What do you think, Kara?
Yeah, you know, that was a major focus of my book, kind of the almost century-old ties between 4-H and agribusiness. And I did find instances of, 4-H getting funding from organizations that do have input into its curricula. So one example, I came across a lesson plan that was all about soy lecithin, which is kind of, you know, an emulsifier. And the lesson was all about, oh, you know, make yourself a glass of Nesquik chocolate milk. And, you know, the thing that makes the chocolate dissolve into the milk is soy lecithin. Soy lecithin is this wonderful thing. And sure enough, the sponsor of this curriculum was DuPont, which is one of the largest producers of soy lecithin. So, you know, you can kind of see how... the agenda of the agribusiness companies is indeed reflected in 4-H, which the companies sponsor.
On a par, when you consider everything, let me ask it this: who do you see as some of the standard bearers of agriculture today and agricultural literacy?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand.
The standard bearers, those who are leading the work of improving agricultural literacy? Or is there anybody?
Certainly. That's, I mean, 4-H without a doubt. And, you know, one of the things that I end my book on a note, I guess this is somewhat of a spoiler alert, but I end my book on a note of encouraging 4-H to really do some deep thinking about the food system and about what we want this next generation of farmers and eaters and fabric wearers to really understand about our food systems. And, you know, do we want them to be fed a line from agribusiness companies, or do we want them to really critically think about sustainability, about how we can, you know, keep farmers, farmers' jobs viable, how we can keep small farms, family farms going, you know, it, 4-H really has a very, very, very powerful platform with 7 million members. And what do they want to teach those 7 million kids about our food systems?
Mm-hmm. And in the end, when it's all balanced out, do you think it's a good thing, the way it's instructed, the way with what student, I shouldn't say what students, but what 4-H'ers take away from their experience overall?
You know, I do. I think the 4-H'ers that I followed, they get so much out of this. They, you know, to have that kind of experience of that kind of connection with an animal, you know, and then to understand that the meat that they see at the supermarket, you know, what it takes to get that meat there, that kind of thing is, it's really, really incredibly valuable. And that's to say nothing of the leadership skills and, you know, some of the socializing that we were talking about before. This is an incredibly positive influence on young people's lives. And I think that 4-H has an opportunity to, you know, make it even more so with their programming.
Kira, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It was a lot of fun talking about 4-H and about your book. Appreciate it very much.
Larry, thank you so much for having me.
Kira Butler is senior editor at Mother Jones and has authored RAISE, What 4-H Teaches 7 Million Kids, and How Its Lessons Could Change Food and Farming Forever. Great to have her along here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we're going to sort of keep our topic along agricultural lines and the 4-H experience. You know, it's really key for many people in our state, as we've heard. And I bet that many of our farmers today learned through that program early in life. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Ed Janis, who directs a project called The People Remember, which is gathering oral histories of Wisconsin farm people to make sure that those stories are not lost. It's a fascinating project, and I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.